to Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is brought to you by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Berry.
Welcome, everyone. Nice to have you here on Home and Family Finance. I'm sitting in with my son, Tally Berry, who will co-host with us through this show today. And for good reason, Tally was one of those in attendance at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They released last month the first ever PISA, it's a program for international student assessment. They released their research, which was focused on financial literacy. And Tally, I think it was a watershed moment in terms of what we're all about here.
Yeah, absolutely. PISA, as you said, PISA is the Program for International Student Assessment, an initiative of the OECD. And every 3 years, they test 15-year-olds in countries around the world to measure levels of achievement in reading, math, and science. In 2012, PISA added financial literacy for the first time, and there were 18 participants. And the point's to measure where countries around the world are and see what we can do to improve achievement in these subjects.
And these were young people. 15-year-olds were the ones that were assessed in this 15 program.
15-year-olds, exactly.
All right. We're going to talk with Shannon Schuyler. She is a partner and U.S. leader for corporate responsibility at PwC. That's PricewaterhouseCoopers. And she was one of those who spoke at the PISA launch at George Washington University. And by way of background, Shannon's vision, it was that vision that led to PwC's launch of what they called EYF, Earn Your Future, in 2012, a commitment to invest more than $160 million in cash donations and volunteer hours to youth education over 5 years. And EYF is working to reach more than 2.5 million students and educators. And to date, they're serving approximately 900,000 students and 19,000 educators. So it is only right from our perspective is that she join us to tell us from her point of view what this information means to her and to the effort put forth by PwC. Shannon, welcome to Home and Family Finance. Nice to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I mean, it's such an important topic, as both of you have said, and to keep a focus on it is something that we need to continue to do if we ever want to make real inroads in this area.
Did you obviously feel the way we feel that this was, whatever else happened that day or happened last month or this year, nothing could be more important than to put a marker down as to where we are, and where we are is not the best place at this point.
I completely agree. It was a very interesting day that after all these years of having the PISA survey that they finally incorporated core questions about financial capability. And it was the first time then we are able to look at that information and to try to determine how people learn and how people become financially literate. Because in the past, when you look at studies around financial literacy in schools, people just say it doesn't work and you can't teach people financial literacy. But what this assessment said is that you can. And there's things that we should look at to make sure we're teaching those key points with to make them stickier and to make students appreciate them more.
What do you think is the reason? I called it, and as Tally has heard me say and probably sick of it by now, I called it we play educational roulette. We give our kids a little science, a little history, a little math in case they become teachers or whatever they're going to. But the one thing that we know they're going to be, Shannon, we know they're going to be consumers. We know they're going to be consumers in the marketplace. And yet we don't demand or require that they even balance their checkbook coming out of high school. What's going on here?
I think it's interesting. This is one of those topics that people are afraid to talk about. I mean, money, like some other topics that are out there, it's very personal, and people think you shouldn't be talking about money because that means you're talking about what you don't know, and there's really nothing more scary than not knowing how to manage a checkbook or what to do with the dollar bills that are in your wallet. And so I think it's become a very taboo topic, and so instead of actually trying to fix it, people just hope that it's being taught at home. They hope your friend teaches you, and it has really gotten itself outside of the school system. And so it's been easy to say, hey, it just doesn't look like we can teach it. So I'm sure it just will get done on the personal side. And to your point, if we can't get this right, there's going to be no future investors. There's not going to be a future business leaders, because this isn't just about how do you manage your checkbook, but how do you make good decisions?
Absolutely.
How do you think critically? And that's fundamental to whatever people want to do.
And the other thing that Tally and I noticed is that the top leader in this study was, Shanghai, right?
Shanghai.
And let's face it, they have poor people in Shanghai. I mean, they have a strata in terms of financial capability. We often say here, well, they're not learning because of their financial condition and so on. So maybe to some degree that's true, but that doesn't stop you from teaching and learning to be good financial managers.
I agree. And what we're seeing is some of the countries who actually scored better do a lot more with integrating key learning points around financial literacy into other subject matter experts. So it's not about having a standalone financial literacy course. It's about how do you teach financial literacy when you're teaching math, when you're teaching reading comprehension, when you're teaching computer science. So it becomes something that you're taught much more often with greater frequency. And then it starts to be something that when you come up to an experience that has to do with money or your finances, you recall the scenario that you learned. Versus right now, I think a lot in the U.S., we hope that a standalone course that will happen when somebody may or may not be their junior year in high school. Mm-hmm. Somehow that's going to fix everything from that point forward. And it's clearly not working.
Right. That's one of the things that stuck out at the conference was that Shanghai and some of the other high achievers didn't necessarily focus explicitly on financial literacy. Their students just had the skills in other topics to apply logically what they knew to problems of financial literacy.
Well, and it's also troubling. There's a study that Junior Achievement has worked on that's about to release that a quarter of all students who take out financial loans think they're going to be forgiven. So they think once they're going to get through college that those will go away.
Wow.
And so it totally correlates to the fact that 41% of students who take out loans default at some point within their first 5 years. So, of course, they're going to default because a lot of them don't even think they're ever going to have to pay it back.
That's very interesting, Jenna. We'll talk more about that. I mean, you know, you can't, if you don't know how the bus works, you can't drive it. If you don't know how the system works, you can't use it. And yet, here we are at an early age indebting these children to get an education. We're talking with Shannon Schuyler. When we come back, we'll talk more about this issue, about the PISA results, and a call to action to you. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
Paul Berry here, Tally Berry with us as we talk with Shannon Schuyler, partner and U.S. leader for corporate responsibility at PricewaterhouseCoopers. They are in the middle of an initiative that is all about the business folks of financial literacy, of educating young people to become knowledgeable and effective and informed consumers. Because I think, Shannon, you realize from a business point of view is that if the person that you are hiring doesn't understand the business world or how to take care of their own business, they're not going to be very effective in your organization, are they?
No, they're not. And I think what PwC is looking at is we know that the folks who are coming, we're not going to have all these people come and end up working at PwC. But when you look at the reach that we have and the clients that we have, these folks are going to go work someplace. And so whether it's wanting to make sure that we have an employee base that has that very sound financial acumen, or whether it's somebody who's going to work at a store that we're going to shop at or a client that we have, it's important for the entire economy and marketplace for people to have this critical skill of trying to understand how our financial markets work and how they can be a positive part of it.
Right. Yeah, it's a good thing PricewaterhouseCoopers is doing because, you know, you guys are all around the world as well, which is one of the interesting things with PISA. This push is mostly in the United States. I think the $160 million your company is investing. Do you engage with the rest of the world in this topic?
You know, it's interesting. We do. And what we find is the education system, as you all know, is very different in the U.S. than it is other places.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in individual parts of Europe and Australia, and you saw that Australia, through the PISA survey, did score very highly or more so than the U.S. there are countries that are really taking hold of this, because certainly the U.S. isn't the only one that has financial issues within our economy. So others are picking up. We specifically are not just doing this in the U.S., but we actually started a lot of what we're doing in Belize, where we've adopted all the public schools in Belize City and have taught them now for 7 years entrepreneurship and financial literacy, which has led to an increased use of their banks, as well as new companies and small little shops that have now grown out of the trainings that we've done with the students for the tourist industry. We also do things in Mexico and in Brazil to really also figure out how do we take this large Earn Your Future commitment and really expand it.
The thing, there's so much to talk about. This is not Chicken Little, folks. This is we can't compete on a global scale if our young people are unable to keep up with the young people from other countries who are, and it is now a global economy. So who's teaching? Who should be? Are our teachers qualified to teach financial literacy in the United States, Shannon?
Thing is, some are and some aren't. And so one of the things that we found and were alarmed by when we started looking at this issue in 2012 was that there were so many states that had mandated financial literacy training in high school, but they hadn't trained the teachers on what to actually teach and if they felt comfortable around the topic themselves. And so what we've done is we've worked a lot with Knowledge at Wharton and other organizations to actually bring teachers together to teach them about their own financial literacy and then to help them get resources. And so we have about 40 different modules that are free for teachers to be able to take to their classrooms, as well as there's a lot of other good training and lessons that are out there that teachers just didn't have access to before. So it's critical that the teachers get that information, but then also there's a different form of teacher today where it's not necessarily the person in the classroom, but the person at your church or the person at your community center. And so we want to make sure that everyone becomes empowered to be able to share these lessons.
And again, as I indicated, we're talking with Shannon Schneider, partner and U.S. leader for corporate responsibility at PwC. And when we come back, we'll ask her to grade us from her perspective and a call to action. What should you be doing? And how can you make sure that our schools from kindergarten right through in every class somehow make the connect between whatever they're teaching and financial literacy? It all works together, folks. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry. Listening to Radio America. I'm your host, Paul Berry, and we thank you for joining us here on Home and Family Finance. Our program sponsor is the Defense Credit Union Council, and we thank them for their continued support of this program, dedicated to making all of us smarter consumers. The Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of Military Saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops. Military Saves is a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, support, and encourage military families to save money, reduce debt, and build wealth, something we all should be doing. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves. Set a goal, make a plan, save automatically. Go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. And whether you're in the military or not, Tally, you ought to be saving anyway. We understand that. Our guest today is Shannon Schuyler, who is one of the partners at PwC. And they've started a program that I think, if more businesses were doing this, we'd be further along the line in terms of getting our young people more educated when it comes to financial literacy. You know, no question.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important that businesses get into this because, you know, it's not helpful for businesses to have uninformed consumers, especially if they're responsible businesses like PwC doing good work. There are some tools available to help out in the public sector. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which we mention often, is fighting the good fight, led by Director Richard Cordray. let me see, the resource center from the President's Council, the advisory council to the president, the financial capability advisory led by John Rogers, is also working hard to educate American youths. And one thing you can do, I want to mention, is the Council for Economic Education puts out an advocacy toolkit with all the tools you need to make
it available to the public.
Available to the public. You can look that up online. The Council for Economic Education Policy and Advocacy Toolkit.
Okay. And Shannon, are we talking your language here?
You absolutely are. We work very closely with CEE on different types of assessments and trying to bring together all the great things that people are doing and make sure that they we can see what progress looks like. The President's Council has been a wonderful advocate with pushing this forward and, mm-hmm. and showing where it is on the President's agenda. And certainly other groups are very proactive in really talking about what does this look like and what do you do to actually address certain constituency groups? Because this is not a one-size-fits-all, and we have to make sure that we're having conversations that make sense based upon different demographic groups, based upon access to capital in different cities, et cetera.
We'd be interested from your perspective, first of all, to give us a grade. Are we A, B, C, or D, or failing? And what we should be doing, call to action to our audience, Shannon, that's so important. I've got people listening. They say, okay, I hear you. You harp on this every month. What can I do? And I want you to, from your perspective, what should they be doing and how are we doing?
Well, it's interesting. I think that we have made a lot of progress in now really understanding what the issue is. And so I think for a long time, we were probably just trying to tackle the issue without really tracking to see where we were going. Mm-hmm. And I think the PISA gives us a good place to say, you know what, we're about average, right? And so whether you say we're at a C or a B minus, we're in that range, and then we can go up certainly from there. I think this is an issue that people should look at throughout the stages of their life. And so it doesn't matter if you're talking to an elementary school student about a piggy bank, if you're helping a student with, they get a dollar for their birthday or an allowance, if you're talking about the first credit cards that now start to come in the mail in junior high school or high school, and when people start looking at loans and mortgages, et cetera, that all along the continuum are learning points. Mm-hmm. And each individual doesn't have to know all of them, but they just need to know the ones that are right around where they are so they can inform somebody who's more junior to them. And so even if it's talking about wants versus needs, that's a huge discussion and isn't one that's complicated with very hard financial terms. It's what could I have in the long term if I make different decisions in the short term?
Right.
Those are the conversations we want people to have because that's the fundamental learning point around financial capability, not just how to look at interest rates. It's how to look at things critically.
You know, it couldn't be better said. What you're really saying is let's do a complete job here and make sure that everybody learns what they need to know from the time they start and to becoming financially literate. Thank you so much, Shannon. I appreciate your time. I know you're busy with lots going on. Come back and see us again, would you please?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Okay.
Thank you for your wonderful
pleasure.
Work.
You bet. Thank you so much. And we'll be back with her again because this is worthwhile. Coming up next, Susan Garland. About retirement? Already? We just got a job. Stay with us.
You be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
Pleased to be with you as we continue here with Tally Berry on mic with me here. You know, if life teaches us nothing else, it teaches us to expect the unexpected. And that doesn't change just because you've grown older and wiser. Even as you do so, Tally, and you will have that experience in your life, the unexpected is always going to happen. So at some point in your young life, you will learn that planning for retirement, and you may be a great planner, but there are things that come up that you don't know what happened. And so we thought it was very appropriate that Kiplinger's.com in their most recent publication came up with a retirement report exploring how to budget for unexpected costs in retirement. So what might they be? Well, we've turned now to the editor of Kiplinger's Retirement Report. That's Susan Garland, a personal finance publication. At least she is not a publication. She is one who wrote for it. But before joining Kiplinger in 2006, Ms. Garland was a freelance writer whose work appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Business Week, Fortune Small Business, and other publications for 12 years. She was a Washington-based correspondent for Business Week covering the White House, national politics, social policy, and legal affairs. She's a graduate of Colgate University. And Susan, I read all of that so people know what the heck you're talking about here, huh?
Thank okay. you.
Welcome to the show. Nice to have you on the show here.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We all should draw up retirement spending plans. Figuring out how to work it out. But there are some things that we may not be able to plan for. So what are those things and what should we be doing?
All right, when people sit down, and a lot of people don't even do this, but they should, they're sitting down to come up with a retirement budget. They usually put down utilities and the lawn care and the insurance, the homeowner's insurance and so forth, and maybe they'll ratchet it up every year for inflation. And then they think, okay, I'm all set. But then they don't plan for two types of bumps in the road. One is the total surprise. Your adult child comes back, loses his or her job, mm-hmm. and needs a big cash infusion from mom and dad, and you hadn't planned for that. And maybe your parents are in financial trouble, too, and you didn't realize they were in trouble. Mm-hmm. The others are things that you can plan for, and they can be expected, but there are big spikes in expenses that you may not have accounted for in your monthly expenses because they're not monthly expenses. And I'm talking about big dental costs, for instance. Medicare does not cover dental care. And so maybe you'll have a $10,000 bill for implants or whatever that could just really throw you for a loop. And other things like the roof. The roof caved in. And I should have planned for that, but I didn't put away money for that. So that's those kinds of things you could have planned for. They're spikes, but your monthly budget doesn't account for that.
So what it seems like you're saying that you do your plan and plan, but then save even more, put even more away for the things that you can't know are going to happen.
So what you should be doing, in addition to your monthly expenses, your budget, you should set aside, the best way probably is to do emergency cash reserve, a fair amount of money you put aside so that when the time comes, if you need, and this should not be counted in your monthly calculation.
Okay.
This is separate.
So a cash reserve separately, a cash reserve that you can put in as much as you want or as much as you can.
Yes, and you could actually think about some of the things that could be happening. For instance, health care. Well, a lot of that could be your monthly expenses. For instance, you're going to have to pay for your Medicare premiums and your, your Part B, which pays for doctor's care, your Part D, which is a private prescription drug plan, and your Medigap supplemental insurance. Mm-hmm. You know what they cost now. You could look them up if you're still too young, and then adjust it for inflation over time, or maybe budget for a Medicare Advantage plan, but you're still going to have, according to Fidelity and other analyses, at least $200,000 in out-of-pocket expenses.
Susan, let me be very honest with my audience.
Yes.
I'm over 30,
yes.
Well over 30, and my son is under 30. Now, I'm going to tell you folks, when I was under 30 and even over 30, none of this meant anything. I didn't care about it. I didn't care about it. Didn't somebody would say, "Retire? I got plenty of time." Tally, mm-hmm. How do you feel about this? I'm just saying, do you care about retirement at this point? You're under 30.
Well, yeah. I've got a long time, I guess. It feels like that now. But there is a dawning awareness among my peers, I think, that the earlier you start saving, the money really stacks up with compound interest and the length of time. So if I start putting away a couple thousand dollars a year now, you know, it's going to be worth twice as much as if I start putting that much away, even 5 or 6 years from now. So that's important. And I understand I have a chance to really, really start saving that 10% cash reserve you're talking about.
Are you going to do it?
I'm gonna try to do it. The roof can only cave in so many times before my fund runs out.
Well, the cash reserve for retirement, you know, it's good to save for retirement. Definitely, we always say that. The cash reserve for those unexpected expenses, you could do that later on. You should definitely put aside money in a retirement fund. The earlier you can, the better off you are. I keep telling my 20-year-old daughter she should start doing this, and she looks at me like, you know, really? Retirement? You must be kidding. And I'm, you know, the retirement person. So, but yes, definitely save as early as you can, as much as you can. These reserves are for, you know, that, you know, your child, your future child, if in case you know, that person ever needs help, and for that, and for that roof. So that's, you know, and, you know, having that money to, you know, thinking about this, you know, as you're approaching retirement, early in retirement, is also good. So you're not blindsided. Let's say you're planning to go away to Europe every other year, and you really want to do this, and you have other priorities. Well, let's say your daughter really needs help. She gets a divorce or whatever, and she's got two kids. Mm-hmm. Then maybe you already know. You've already said, you know what, we're willing to give up that European vacation, and you've already had that in mind that might be the backup if there's ever any problem, you know, bump in the road.
Sure, and
it
can happen.
You're used to it.
Yeah. So we're talking with Susan Garland, folks. And that's the other thing. You're reserved, but what about the bump on the road? What are you prepared to give up as well, Susan? As we're talking with her about retirement, getting planning for the unexpected, something that we all should be doing. When we come back, we'll talk to her also about saving for capital expenses and covering the cost of health care. Important stuff that just might happen to you. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Depends Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
And Tully, I think you were provoked to a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, so at my age, I can start putting away that little cash reserve. But if I'm getting close to 65, close to retirement, and I haven't done that yet, I guess the answer is maybe I'm planning a budget of $6,000 a month and I don't have a cash reserve. Maybe I cut that down to $5,000 a month and that does give me the cash reserve. Is that how you do it? You have to give something up?
Exactly. Or even in retirement, what you can do is instead of planning, you know, you start cutting back on your expenses and you put a certain bit of money away from the budgeted money that, you know, that you've set aside maybe for going out to dinner or whatever, you stick it aside into this cash reserve. So in the years before retirement, in the years even after retirement, if you don't have that money set aside, think every month of putting aside a certain amount of money into this cash reserve, money that you can get to easily. And the good thing about that, too, is having this extra money is that, let's just say you retire, the stock market goes down, and you need this money for expenses, even your monthly expenses. You don't want to sell your stocks when the stock market is down. It's going to be very hard to recoup, you know, to make up for that in the markets, you know, in the years later. So having a cash reserve lets you not touch that, you know, those stocks and having to sell those stocks when the market is down.
We're talking with Susan Garland, editor of Kiplinger's Retirement Report. Susan, the other thing I thought was very important is that you delineate between a cash reserve and a replacement reserve. What's the difference here?
Well, the difference is the capital expenses, and there's a really great guy, Bud Hiebler, Henry Hiebler, who's a former top executive of the Boeing Corporation, and he always was budgeting. Now he's a retirement expert, but he was always budgeting for capital expenses at Boeing. And so what he's come up with, and if you want to figure this out yourself, he has a website called analyzenow.com, and he has all these spreadsheets where you can do a lot of this figuring yourself. But he basically says, look, you know, know that your roof's going to go. You know your refrigerator's going to go. You know your stove's going to go. So all these big expenses that, you know, you're going to have to paint your house.
Right.
They're big capital expenses.
Do you include these reserves in calculating your regular retirement expenses?
Well, I mean, what you should be, yes, you can, but this is the thing. And if you're doing your monthly budget,
you know,
you don't know what month that roof is going to, you know, cave in. So this is why you have your replacement reserve. It could be part of your bigger reserve, but it's something that it doesn't have to be exact, but you don't want to be blindsided. So let's just say you know your roof is going to cost $10,000 and it lasts 20 years. You're 5 years into that, you know, 20-year life cycle of your roof, so you should have saved, you know, a quarter of that, $2,500, you know, assuming you did. Then for the next 15 years, you put aside $500 a year, and so by the time that roof, you know, you need the roof replaced, you have the $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically says, no, you don't have to account for inflation. You're putting this into an investment account, so hopefully the returns will be the same as inflation, so it'll be a wash. It's not exact, but it's, you know, it's something. So that $10,000 time comes, you have some extra cash.
And the nice thing about that is if nothing happens, it's still your money. You can use it as you want, right?
Exactly. But you know what? Maybe the roof will come in, you know, 2 years, you know, fall in 2 years later.
So yeah, you just don't know.
You know, at the 20th anniversary, you don't want to, like, celebrate.
Yeah.
And
if I hear you, what you're saying in the bigger picture, Bones, is that, you know, give yourself some space. Save some for what you don't know it's going to happen. And because, as we said, life teaches us that unexpected things happen. So you're smart if you just go above and beyond and save what you can. Don't hurt yourself, but save what you can. And it's ultimately your money anyway at the end of the day.
Well, you know, there's an old saying for it. It's a rainy day fund. You know, so it's the same thing. And, you know, if your roof comes, you know, falls in, then you really, you know, it really is a rainy day fund.
Yeah.
So that's a way to think of it, too.
I think it's so important. And I think what Tally pointed out, and Tally, again, I think that's wise, is that it's time to start. You know, we sometimes think, well, I'll wait till I'm 40, I'll wait till I'm 35, I'll wait till I'm 50. No, I mean, and the nice thing about savings, too, Susan, is that once you start saving, it kind of grows you on you. I mean, you look over there and that fund is growing, it's getting bigger, and you want it to get bigger. In other words, the more you save, the more you want to save. I think that's a fair statement, isn't it, Susan?
I think so. It's a good habit to get into, and especially if you are working and you have a 401k and you get yourself in some kind of automatic set-aside, you know, you will not only will that money compound and grow, especially if you get an employer match, but you know, you won't spend what you don't have. So you'll get used to living on less, and then you get these statements, and it's like, wow, that's great, and I didn't even suffer to do it. So, you know, and you'll be happy. Even young people, I didn't think of this when I was, you know, younger, and teens early in my 20s. I mean, retirement, I mean, that's like, you know, you just never thought of it.
I know.
Now.
It's like, oh, me? Retire? Me? Are you kidding? We're talking with Susan Garland. When we come back, we're going to talk about that biggie, folks, healthcare costs over and above. What happens then? Are you prepared? And it can absolutely wipe you out. Susan will have more coming up. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, along with Tally Berry. We're talking with Susan Garland, editor of Kiplinger Retirement Report, and we're talking about those unexpected costs in retirement.
If you retire, you're probably on Medicare time. You're working with Medicare for your health insurance. Does Medicare cover everything? If you've got Medicare, you don't have to worry, right?
No. It covers a lot, but it doesn't cover everything by any means. First of all, it doesn't cover long-term care, so that's like a big thing. So that's one thing you should be aware of. And also, there are a lot of gaps in Medicare. So you want to make sure that the co-payments from the doctors, the deductibles, the co-insurance adds up to a lot of money. Doesn't cover unless you're part of a Medicare Advantage plan. Some plans cover dental. Traditional Medicare does not cover dental, does not cover vision. So if you have need eyeglasses, hearing aids, all those incidentals can really add up. Hearing aids these days, a lot of money. So you need to be thinking about that. So one of the things you want to do, you want to obviously sign up for Medicare when you're 65. And then you have two ways of going about it. You can sign up for a Part D prescription drug plan, which is a private plan you buy from a private insurance company, and that will cover a good part of your drug costs, but not all of them. You still have co-payments, and you also want to sign up for a Medigap supplemental insurance private policy too, which will fill in many of the gaps depending on the type of policy you buy.
That's so important, Susan. That's so important, that Medigap, that supplemental insurance policy, especially when you start to, and it's not the big deal that Medicare covers, maybe, but it could be 20% of your cost. And if you've got some serious injuries, we're talking about not hundreds but thousands of dollars that you have to come up with.
Exactly. And Medigap is expensive. It's not cheap. But what it does is really takes away the volatility, those spikes, in your health care costs. So you know every month basically what your premiums are going to be for all three, and they could be pretty hefty.
Yeah.
Maybe $500 per person if you have a spouse. So that's it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it's going to be more money if you don't do it.
You know what, Susan? Let me just share with my audience this. You're absolutely right. I had the Medigap. I'm in Medicare, so and so, and I had the Medigap program, and I was looking at it, and it was so expensive that I dropped it. I said, I'm not going to pay $500 every 3 or 4 months or whatever. And then lo and behold, guess what? My gallbladder gave out. Who knew that my gallbladder was not going to last beyond my, as far as I last? And so, and guess what? Now Medicare paid for my operation, but who do you think's paying for those other, and they're not nibbly-dibbly. Absolutely. I mean, more than any of those costs combined. So, as you point out, and I just emphasize that, it is worth the sacrifice because you don't know what's going to happen to you, do you, Susan?
Yes, and a lot of people don't realize too that once you drop your Medigap, or if you don't take it within, I think it's 6 months of applying for Medicare Part B, which is traditional Medicare, the companies could do medical underwriting. So that means they don't have to take you, or they could charge you more.
Yep.
So you, I don't know if you're trying to get Medigap.
I'm back. I'm trying
again.
Desperately. You're absolutely right.
It might be really difficult. So, yeah, it's expensive, and yeah, you think you may not need it, but it's worth getting. It's insurance, and that's what insurance is for. Or you could join a Medigap Advantage plan, which basically is a private health insurance plan. It covers drugs. It covers the gaps to a great degree. It covers the hospital, your doctor care. It should be cheaper than the other three together. But you will be restricted in the provider networks. So if you love your doctors or you love your hospitals, choose a plan that either will include those providers.
Right.
And if not, then you're just going to have to change doctors, which could be perfectly fine. So
or not.
It depends on what's important.
That's
to you.
Right.
Yeah, they do come with restrictions.
Thank you, Susan. Listen, folks, if you think this doesn't apply to you, just keep living. Okay? That's all you got to do. Just keep living. Susan Garland, thank you so much for joining us. Come back and see us again soon, would you?
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. A pleasure to have you. Tally, thank you so much for sitting in on this and joining in the conversation.
My pleasure.
Al Peterson, engineer extraordinaire, thank you so much for your time. If there's a topic or subject you want to discuss, please write to me here. Paul Berry at Radio America, 1100 North Glebe Road, Suite 900, Arlington, Virginia, 22201. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. I'll be here. Will you?